not sure if there's a name for this particular group of people, but there are those, and I have to admit I'm one of them, who love maps. The details and the places I'm yet to explore. So I was shocked to find out that there isn't and never will be an accurate map. But as my next guest will explain, that doesn't at all distract from the vast amount, or even detract, I think it is, from the vast amount of information they contain and how we make sense of ourselves as well as understanding the world around us. Maps also provide a form of big history, particularly charting different eras of power and how they change the perspectives of how countries sit alongside each other in the world. And this is exactly what Jerry Broughton has explored in his book, A History of the World in 12 Maps. Jerry's Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University of London, and he presented the 2010 BBC 4 series, Maps, Power, Plunder and Possession. And I'm delighted to welcome him on the line now from the UK. Welcome to Saturday Extra.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
This is rather absurd in a way, as we seem to rely on maps to show us precisely where places are. But you say there never can be an accurate map of the world, and there never will be. Why not?
Because the only accurate map of the world can ever be on a scale of 1 to 1. And, of course, that's completely useless. You know, writers like Borges, the great Argentinian writer, Lewis Carroll, write short stories saying, you know, we've made this map in these imaginary kingdoms and we realise that the only way to have a completely accurate map is make it on a scale of 1 to 1. And, you know, Lewis Carroll, they say, oh, that doesn't really work. And in the Borges story, they say, well, of course, the map just falls to pieces because it's of no use. So every map has to make selective decisions about what it puts on and what it leaves off. Famous Polish philosopher called Alfred Korzybski once famously said, the map is not the territory. So the map never is an exact copy or replica of the territory that it shows you. And that works from local regional maps right up to world maps, which is particularly what I'm interested in, because, of course, if you're looking at a globe, you can't square the circle. You can't put a globe onto a flat piece of paper, you know, make a rectangular map without some form of distortion.
Well, without some decision making. I mean, the point you make is that...
Yeah, and what you put on and what you leave off. And even the Greeks knew that. The Greeks said, we know that the Earth is like this. So any map has to make certain compromises. But I was just interested in saying, well, as soon as map makers know that, and they've known that throughout history, then what kind of decisions do they make and what informs what they put on the map and what they leave off the map? And that was really the starting point of writing this book.
You also say it's impossible to ever define a map as finished. Again, what do you mean by that?
Well, because it's, as we say here in the UK or in Scotland, it's a bit like painting the fourth bridge. You know, once you get to the end, you have to start at the beginning again because it's all changed. And you think, of course, about national surveys in any sort of part of the globe, that a national survey of a nation state, once it's, as it were, completed, then there are political, geographical changes, there are even physical changes to the landscape. You know, the Earth changes, it never stays still. So in a sense, the mapping has to change with it. So, you know, here in the UK, the Ordnance Survey, our national mapping organisation, you know, has to create maps upon maps upon maps, and they respond to the changes on the landscape as well. So they're never really finished. And, you know, I think, again, because any mapmaker knows that they've made decisions about what they haven't put on the map, they could always go back in and say, we could just add something else. We could just add something else. And it's back to the 1-to-1 scale joke, you know. You can carry on with the map until you actually make it absolutely coextensive with the territory that it shows. So in a sense, they're never really finished.
Yes, I mean, you give examples of the Cassini survey, and you can tell us about what an amazing landmark event in history that was and how that led ultimately, I suppose, to the British Ordnance Survey, the most famous of all national surveys. But tell us about the Carte de Cassini, this unprecedented step in the history of map making.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredibly important move, that it's really all modern map making really goes back to what these four generations, this dynasty of French map makers called the Cassinis, who start from the late 17th century, go right through to the late 18th century. And actually, the map is in the 1780s and 90s, when the revolution happens, when the French Revolution takes place. The revolutionary authorities are so fascinated and see the power of this map that the Cassinis have been making for all these decades that they nationalize the map. It's the first map of a nation which is nationalized. They say, right, we're having that. And Napoleon Bonaparte, it's a fantastic map, we've got to have this. What was amazing about it was it's the first survey of a nation which uses modern scientific methods, that uses surveying methods, using trigonometry. Teams of people fan out across France, you know, doing these vast surveys, you know, going down into the Matisse Central, you know, doing these unbelievably difficult mapping exercises. And the maps were all then fed back to Paris and were on one uniform scale. They were printed in the same way. They were standardized in a way you've never seen before. And the resulting carte de Cassini, the map made by the Cassinis, showed the kingdom in a scale that had never been seen before. Mm. And I love the joke. As being an Englishman, I say, you know, actually it's the French who invent that kind of modern map making. And we always think it's the ordnance survey as Brits, but actually the French got there first.
Got there first. And so what about, I want to come back to that history because it's so interesting, but I do want to throw right forward to the present. What about Google Map? Are the Cassinis the precursors of the ultimate precise map makers, namely Google Map, using satellite imagery?
Well, they sort of absolutely are, and then they're absolutely not. They are in the sense because of that belief in using the latest up-to-date technology, which now, of course, is satellite data. So Google and Apple map applications on your mobile devices are using satellite data, which they're basically crunching, to then create those online maps. So in a sense, it's very much like using the surveying methods that the Cassinis were using. But what's interestingly different, I think, and I really do think that we're living through a revolution, really, of mapping. Your mapping's going online. It's going virtual. The paper map is in decline. And I don't particularly think that that's a terribly bad thing, because maps have always transcended the media. You know, we've made them on rock, on papyrus, on printed paper, and now they're going into digital format. But what's really important that we need to remember is that unlike the Cassini maps, which are state-owned, mapping is now going back into private hands. So the long history of cartography and mapping always shows us that maps have always been in private hands. But we like to feel, as late modern people, that mapping should be the responsibility of the nation state. And it has been since the Cassinis. The online mapping revolution is changing that. And I think that's a real serious concern that we ought to have, because those multinational corporations now have more buying power. They have more big data than national governmental organizations across the globe. And that is something that we really need to think about very carefully, that we're okay with that. And actually, I'm not okay with it.
Well, what would they do, though? I mean, it's not in their interests to be inaccurate, is it?
No, it's not, but it is in their interest, of course, precisely because that's what they're in. It's a business model. They're interested in basically monopolizing the market. I mean, that's basically what Google is trying to do, is have absolute preeminence in search, and that's why Apple came along last year and launched its own map applications, because, as you say, you know, the map has now become absolutely ubiquitous. The map is a way in which we basically move around both the internet and our own physical space. So what Google and Apple have realized is that a map is crucial to any form of search that you do online. And this staggered me when I talked to the people at Google, that they said over 40% of all searches that you put into Google have some geographical content. And so you realize, aha, that's why the map is so important to them. You know, you put in hotel in Madrid, you get a map. You know, you put in nearest Indian restaurant to me, you get a map. Mm. But of course, that's driven by commercial imperatives. You know, Google and Apple, particularly Google, make predominantly their money through advertising. So it's about people, again, paying to be on that map. And my concern, no, it's not that they might produce inaccurate maps, but again, it's back to the age-old story that I'm trying to tell in the book, which is who gets put on the map and who gets left off the map.
Gerry Broughton is my guest today on Saturday Extra. He's Professor of Renaissance Studies at Queen Mary University in London, and he is obsessed with maps, and we're lucky he is because it is a magnificent obsession. Look, I've just got to delve a little more, because what if this wondrous possibility of knowledge around maps is just spread much further because of very clever commercialism? I can't see what the problem is. I don't know what you're worried about.
I'm worried about the way in which basically maps are now going into private hands and they're being driven by commercial agendas. That's what worries me, that we've seen that maps are often literally the treasure map. A treasure map is about, you know, finding something that, you know, gives you wealth, you know, gives you money. You know, the map is always a key to basically getting something. But this has changed in a way and has reached a point that we've never seen before. And my other problem is that nobody knows actually how those maps are made. So we don't know about the source code. And that's fair enough, because in a sense, companies like Google would say, look, we've created these search engines and we've created these applications. But nevertheless, we've never seen that kind of possession of secretive information, because before we've just said, well, we know what the code is. It's a certain kind of map projection, or they've got certain kinds of data by going out into the field. And Google is now saying, we own that, and that is private, and people are now having to basically pay for that.
So it's a bit like the genome projects, that whole argument around who owns the genes, isn't it, and who owns wheat strains and so on. It's another version of this.
Yeah, and similarly with, of course, the way in which Google's been doing this with books. You know, it is a kind of, it is a give and take, you know, so in many ways I think that it's kind of wonderful things about when you digitize things like maps or books, but ultimately there is a very powerful business model which stands behind that, which says this stuff is free for the moment, and then there's probably a point where you are charged for it, and then there's a point where you can be on or off the map based on your purchasing power. Well, very nice example, but somebody told me this in London. They said there's an area, a very wealthy area of London called the Dulwich Corporation in southeast London. They pay to stay off Google Maps because they want a certain level of privacy. There are townships in South Africa. There's one I know very well in Cape Town called Philippi. Philippi is not on Google Maps because why would Google want to bother putting a township?
Yes, I see. I see. Because you do say that many people working in academic geography and professional cartography regard Google Earth with suspicion, even alarm. And yet, if I sort of put to you from your history in your book, you say that in effect the urge to map is a basic enduring human instinct, and that it started more than 40,000 years ago, where we developed the ability to translate ephemeral spatial information into permanent and reproducible form. Now, are Google really going to play with that fundamental instinct?
Well, I mean, they're running with it, but I think that they are pushing the possibilities of, you know, I mean, in the US particularly, in terms of the antitrust issues that are going on, there are serious issues about how far Google are going with spatial law. You know, one of the great developments in the US at the moment is practicing in spatial law, because companies like Google are pushing the limits of what they can put on maps. So we know this with Street View, all the jokes about how they're going around hoovering up all this data. Now, yes, they're playing a very, very, there's a thin line between what Google's doing in terms of pushing those limits, making more money, and then crossing a line. And I think that's actually a different issue about what's happened to the heart and soul of the company in the last few years, because as many of us know, when they first started up, it was terribly idealistic. And when I started doing the research and I went to talk to them, I was very positive about what they were doing, because I thought the technology was fantastic. But I think now, as they've just shifted to a new commercial ethos, and clearly it is just really about generating maximum profit, and it's about pushing any competition to one side. Mm. So, I mean, this is not me just as a sort of woolly academic. When I talk to online entrepreneurs who work in online geospatial applications, like at Yell.com, they say, Google is killing us. You know, we are trying to retain a sort of competitive edge, and we can't. And that always worries me, because in the history of cartography, when one organization or an individual or a king or a company says, I control the map, I think that's when maps go from being fantastic, wonderful, exciting, utopian things to really quite dangerous things. Well, if you control the world map, then you control a lot of information about how people move around that world.
Yeah, well, segueing beautifully into my final question, because that is your point, is that, in effect, cartographic power is often aligned with political power and the whole notion of a nation's sense of itself. And I wanted to end with the map that most of us, I think, probably do have hanging somewhere, or have, it's on our wall in somewhere in the world, which is the Peters Projection World map, which was devised by the German historian Arno Peters in 1973, which gave equality to all nations. Now, is that the exemplar for you?
No, I think in a way, I think it's just a really good example of where a very progressive cartographer and historian, which is what Peters was, he lived through the Second World War, he lived through the Cold War, he was an East German socialist historian, and he said, I feel that what's happened is that There's been a sort of focus on Europe, a very Eurocentric map throughout history, and it's one that's denigrated, particularly the developing world, as he put it in the 1970s. And so he said, well, I'm just going to use a different kind of projection. And what's hilarious is that, you know, real geeky people, cartophiles, I guess we'd call them, those people who love the maps would know that he chooses a kind of projection which is called the equal area map projection. And that's a very mathematical term for, you know, how he basically maps surface area. But of course it's ironic that as a socialist he wants that kind of equality, and that's what he gives you.
And he made Africa longer than it had ever been before.
Somebody said it was like underwear being pinned on the North Pole, and it was kind of hanging down, and as is Latin America, and his point was to basically foreground them much more powerfully than they had been in previous mapping traditions. And my new point was that that's fine, but he himself has an agenda. His map still distorts aspects of the globe, because if you look at the North and South Poles, they're stretched to infinity. And, you know, we could talk a lot about how Australasia always gets the bum deal
on these
kind of maps.
It's true.
You know, why is North at the top? There's no reason. I always laugh when Australians, you know, show that map which has South at the top, and everybody laughs at it. And my point is, yeah, why isn't South at the top? There's no reason. There's absolutely no historically compelling reason why South should not be at the top. And again, it's about where you map from and what power that you have.
So we're not down under or at the bottom of the world necessarily.
No, absolutely not. No. No, you're not. You know, just turn the map upside down. It's fine.
Jerry, look, it's so incredibly provocative. And thank you. You've left us with lots to think about. Thank you very much indeed for joining us, and congratulations.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you for talking to me.
Jerry Brotton from Queen Mary University of London. He's Professor of Renaissance Studies there. His book is A History of the World in 12 Maps. Some beautiful pictures in it too. Published by Penguin. And for all those lovers of maps, the National Library in Canberra has just started an exhibition called Mapping Our World, Terra Incognita to Australia. It runs right through until the 10th of March, so a perfect summer break visit.